Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 27th, 2014. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, Chase Healy of Prairie Artisan Ales in Tulsa talks about his rapidly growing Funky Brewery and some of the beers that have gotten the attention of craft beer lovers across the country. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can find me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. We have a show page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're also on Google Plus, too. And thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how it works. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, go to basicbrewing.com first, click on our Amazon ad. That will take you to Amazon, and you can shop just like you always do. You won't pay any extra, but we'll be getting a chunk of whatever you buy. So we greatly appreciate your support there. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Home Brewers Association on our site as well. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes and our Android app on Amazon.com. We're in the BlackBerry podcast directory, we're on the Stitcher app, and we're on the Windows Phone directory, too. Check out our Brewer's Logbook at basicbrewingshop.com. In the front is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews. And there's room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of beer, or mead, or cider, or whatever you want. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support, and thanks to everybody who has done so already. And you can protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at basicbrewingshop.com. There will be a new episode of Basic Brewing Video on the site before the end of the week. This week, Steve and I will take the small batch, all grain, speedy stout we showed you how to brew last week and take it a step further, adding coffee and the mole ingredients that we've used before. That was inspired a bit by one of the Prairie Artisan Ales that I've had. So anyway, it's a fun show. Also on that show, you can see the new Basic Brewing bottle opener, which has been flying out of the online store in a hurry. Enough shameless plugging. I want to talk about boiling in plastic buckets, which we've talked about a couple of times on this show and on Twitter and such. And I've got an email with pictures of people brewing in their plastic buckets and ads for plastic buckets with heating elements built right in so that you can mash and boil right there in your plastic bucket. So I know that mashing and boiling in plastic buckets is real. It's a real thing in parts of the world. And I know that toxicologist Paul says that it seems to be safe from a toxicology standpoint, but, you know, it's always just seemed kind of weird to me to be boiling in a plastic bucket. So when I was over in Tulsa to talk to Chase of Prairie Artisan Ales, I had lunch with Desiree and Dave from High Gravity, the awesome homebrew shop over there, and glass sponsor of the glasses that you'll get at the National Homebrew Conference, by the way. And Desiree said that she and Dave had played with boiling in a plastic bucket in the past, and that she had actually gotten scalded when a seal around a heating element in the bucket failed, spewing boiling wort on her hand. So all that to say, I don't know if the homebrew systems that use the plastic buckets in the UK and Europe and such are using more sturdy buckets than we have over here or not. And I don't know exactly what kind of setup that Desiree and Dave were using, but use extreme caution if you make up your own electric system using a plastic bucket as the centerpiece. Safety first. Being scalded is not a lot of fun. So I know, you know, from the letters and the emails, or the emails, well, letters. Nobody sends me paper letters. From the email and tweets and such that I've been seeing, I know that people brew in plastic buckets successfully. I just don't know the details. And just hearing that story from Desiree about the bucket failing just, you know, made me want to say something on the show that you should be careful with what you're doing there. Okay, let's go on to my conversation with Chase. I could have talked for another hour with him about his collaborations with other breweries, both in the U.S. and abroad, his strategies and using various ingredients and yeast strains that we didn't get to, and so on. But he was very busy trying to get beer packaged up or ready to go because he was leaving out of town the next day to go to Brooklyn to do a tasting up there. And then I think next week he and his assistant brewer Heath are going to Europe. So it's amazing. He's an Oklahoma man who's done good. Chase Healy, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be here.
Where are we?
We are in beautiful Tulsa, Oklahoma, in our small facility here, although it's getting much larger every day. We just put in a couple new 30-barrel fermenters, and every day we get more and more packed in here. So we are growing every day, it seems.
Let's talk about your history, because as far from my perspective, I mean, you guys have just shot out of nowhere, it seems like, and you've gone nationwide in just a fairly short amount of time, and you're getting a lot of traction on, you know, on all the beer sites, and you're getting good reviews, and you're it's just like, you know, where did you guys come from? So start at the beginning. How long ago did you start brewing, and just give me your whole story.
You know, it's really funny that you're actually here interviewing me now. I really, you know, as a brewer about 7-8 years ago, I guess it was more like 8 years ago, you know, like any home brewer, I was just scavenging the internet trying to find sources of information and ways to learn, and it's come full circle that you've come to my brewery, because I really feel like when I was getting started and, you know, buying the kits and starting with extract at, like, High Gravity, you know, it started with listening to your podcast and watching your videos and buying your intro to All Grain DVD and learning how to build a homebrew All Grain system with the mash tun and everything. So it's kind of exciting that you're here, because I feel like it was really one of those sources of information that helped me get my start.
Well, that's awesome. Thanks for saying that, Chase.
Yeah, no, but it's true, and you know, it's exciting. I feel like the point of view where someone maybe my age and other brewers that are kind of, I feel like almost this third wave of brewers, is that we've had the opportunity to have great sources of information and people that have kind of pioneered the stuff before us to look to for information and for inspiration in what we're doing. So it's fun to, you know, be able to kind of see it go full circle and be participating in the things that I used to listen to get information to learn to brew beers. I think it was maybe 2005 when I probably got into brewing. I was a student at the University of Oklahoma, and the brew shop had decided to open a store in Norman. So my girlfriend at the time, that's now my wife, bought me my first homebrew kit. Friends' dads had already been brewing in the Tulsa area with the Foam Club, and so seeing what they were doing, it got me excited about trying it myself. So I think, like any homebrewing geek, you know, it just takes that first time, and then you get more and more obsessed and crazy with it and complicated and go this way and that. And luckily for me, being 23 years old, as when I got into professional brewing, I didn't really have a whole lot else lined up for a career, so it was a good fit for me, where I think maybe sometimes people realize a little too late in the game that it's something they want to do and it gets more challenging. For me, I didn't have a lot to lose, so jumped into it, and the timing was good, where I was really heavy into brewing and wanting to be a professional brewer when a group of guys were starting Coop Ale Works in Oklahoma City, and I was lucky enough to get on board with them and become the brewmaster there. Kind of definitely trial by fire with that. You know, I went to brewing school after being a professional brewer for a year, so there's a lot of on-the-job training. But so I got my start there in about 2008, and from there kind of jumped around on a couple of ideas, knowing that I wanted to open my own brewery. And it kind of took me and my wife selling our home and moving to Texas, where I thought I was going to run a brewery down in Dallas for someone else, and just deciding I can't do this. Like, I really don't want to work for people anymore. And I approached the guys at Chalk about using some of their capacity to brew some beers to help launch a new company. It's something I had kind of done before with a company called Red Bud, but didn't actually own the company. It was a long, complicated deal that I eventually just kind of needed to walk away from, but knew that the concept worked. And they said, yeah, you could do that, you know, and they're like, you probably brew about 5,000 cases in a year here, and that would be great. And that sounded awesome. So we started with the first batch of Prairie Ale, like September 2012, we brewed it. And from there, it just kind of one batch turned into another, and things just kind of really took off. A really important part of that is that while I was working on this brand, Red Bud, I knew I wanted to have a brand and a brewery that we sold beer in a lot of places. I was always really inspired by like Jolly Pumpkin, and realized that why it worked for them is because they used basically an importer to sell their beer in their portfolio, Shelton Brothers. And so while I was working on the Red Bud project, I'd sent them beers and thought it'd be cool to sell beer through them, and got good responses on it. I was brewing farmhouse ales back then. This is like 2010. And so they basically said, whenever you're ready and have enough beer, you know, we'd ship it around for you. And it's kind of something I wasn't ready for at the time, but kind of put in my back pocket. And once Prairie kind of started taking off, we got back in touch and got them some beer, and it just kind of has happened. It's hard to explain. You know, I think I knew what I was doing by trying to work with them to get things out there, but I guess I didn't quite realize like how quickly things would really happen. I mean, everything I'd set out to happen has, except it's just happened in like a year and a half instead of maybe a few years.
Is that a good thing?
It is. You know, it's a challenge because, you know, we're in our small artisan brewer, and we're not a big brewery, and so we're not fancy, you know, we don't have complicated equipment or like a big lab or anything, so it's tough sometimes because, you know, we're pretty experimental, which means we don't always get it right, and sometimes that can happen publicly from time to time. Luckily, it's the situations where that happen are far fewer than you know, it doesn't happen that often, but you know, we're a little brewery that now is trying to play with the big guys, and you know, it's a challenge and it's exciting, and we're growing and learning as we go, and I think getting better every day.
And you are still continuing your relationship with the guys down at Krebs at Chalk. And in fact, we were talking beforehand that you kind of helped them expand their capacity as well.
Yeah, it's become one of those things where, you know, we operate as two separate companies, but we're definitely partners in this deal. And Zach, the president down there, is really, I give him a ton of credit in this, and just kind of recognizing that this Prairie thing was like, you know, people were really excited about it, and more or less giving me the opportunity, the capacity to push on with it versus limit us. And so much credit's due to him for realizing the opportunity along with me and embracing it. And so essentially, yeah, it's worked out well to the point where, you know, we were really trying to meet the demand and just killing ourselves with how many batches we were needing to brew on their 15 barrel. And it took us all going to Germany for a brewing conference to realize we needed a much bigger brew house, and that would really help us. And so we shopped them around while we were out there, but luckily Sweetwater sold their old brew house, and it's crazy because I feel like we're getting huge, like but then like Sweetwater sold their 50 barrel brew house to buy a 400 barrel brew house. So it's freaking crazy how much beer some of these, you know, craft breweries are brewing. And it's exciting to try to feel like we're kind of catching up with them to be a slightly bigger brewery, but I feel like we're still tiny. But so, no, it's a great deal where, you know, we get, especially our Tulsa brewery, a chance to be incredibly experimental and work on things here and then be able to go down there and translate these beers into bigger production runs, which means we get to sell beer all across the country. So, you know, while we're growing in this Tulsa brewery, I'll never not brew beer with those guys. We've created such a relationship, and we're all friends, and we've just worked so well together, and it's exciting. And I don't know why I'd ever not want to keep working with them. I just feel like we're kind of becoming more one thing instead of two separate deals. And it's nice that we can still have our own focuses, but us coming together on these bigger releases for Prairie has been really great.
So what are the beers that are being brewed down there now?
So really anything that we've released up until now has come out of that facility. We've had a couple of beers so far come out of the Tulsa one, and many more to come. April of this year, we'll probably have 3 to 4 different beers come out, but we will never cross over beers as far as one facility to the other. If something was to become really awesome here and we took it there, it would kind of stay there after that, but we're not trying to cross over. So really, the Tulsa facility is focused on more wine barrel aged and funky beers, and in that facility we're focusing more on our stainless beers and spirit barrel aged beers. So, but the bottom line is that with getting that more capacity there, you know, there's just, I couldn't brew enough in the Tulsa facility to justify shipping it like we can the other beers. And that's a really interesting part of the industry that we're learning, is being a brewery that ships to, you know, maybe 30 different markets is it takes a lot of beer. It really does. And we're in a spot now where it's hard to do small runs of stuff unless it's here and it's staying in Oklahoma, because we'll make wholesalers mad if they don't get some of it, you know? So it's a funny situation to be in, but luckily, yeah, so we're able to focus on like our Bira, which is a lighter saison that we do, ale, bomb, and like I said, anything we're going to age in spirit barrels. So we're trying to make that division just because, you know, brewing funky beers and straight beers, clean beers in the same facility is a challenge. And so that's one thing we're trying to do to kind of create a separation. And the breweries are 100 miles apart, so that's a pretty good distance to keep the beast and the bacteria away from the beer.
Are they going to start making you, you know, walk through a disinfectant bath or something before you?
I've certainly been in breweries where you do have to step through some puddles of sanitizer or whatever before you step into the facility, but that was in Europe where they're pretty darn careful about stuff. No, you know, we feel like we understand the different yeast and things we're using to where, you know, we're pretty good about it.
So how big is your brew pot here, or your kettle?
It's 10 barrels. I started with a little 5-barrel system. Not really, just the thing about Prairie is, like, everything we do is just self-funded. So we never had like a big cash investment or anything. So just kind of bought stuff as we've gone along. And so for me, it's like, oh, 5 barrels sounds great. And making 150 gallons of beer at a time is completely stupid. It's just not enough. So especially for us, and maybe that works in smaller settings where people can sell on premise or self-distribute or sell directly to stores, you know, and the distribution kind of thing. But for us, our only option is to sell to wholesale. So you just have to be able to make more beer in that setting, because we don't have the benefit of selling stuff at a retail price. It's, you know, almost getting marked up 100% before it gets anywhere in this case. So in those circumstances, a brewer in Oklahoma, we have to be able to make more beer, or otherwise it'll just never be enough, and, you know, we won't we won't be able to stay afloat. So we switched to the 10 barrel. I knew quickly that the 5 wasn't going to cut it, and luckily there's a great manufacturer in Colorado called Bennett Forge Works, and anyone that's looking to get into professional brewing, I'd recommend looking at his stuff. It's more modular and I think simple. Maybe a home brewer would understand more, but you know, it's similar to any brew house I've ever worked on, and there isn't any complicated manifolds or anything like that. It's pretty basic, and to me, that's always been fine for me. I don't need anything too fancy to brew on. I feel like, you know, where we really do well is in our fermentations and all the blending and things we do. So I like that it's a simple brew house, but 10 barrels, and now we've switched to where we just have 30-barrel fermenters. So we're brewing, basically it works well to brew a single batch one day and pitch yeast on it, and then that yeast gets nice and active in the beer to where the next day we can come in and put two batches on it and, you know, have three batches going in the same tank. So it works well with yeast management, and 30-barrel pitches of yeast are really expensive. So 10s are not. They're still expensive, but it allows us to get more beer into the smaller footprint of our place by brewing into bigger tanks.
So let's move away from the business of brewing into talking about the beers themselves, and our audience is home brewers, and they want tips on how to brew the beers that you brew. So why don't we start with the Bira, which is 4.5% alcohol, really sessionable, but I took tasting notes. I am not a certified BJCP judge, but here's what I wrote. I said, light and refreshing, a bit spicy with a touch of funk, but yet a fairly substantial mouthfeel for that low gravity a beer. So I liked it quite a bit. I liked everything that I've had from you. So talk about that beer, how you brew it, what if you were a home brewer trying to get something like that, give us some tips.
So that beer, yeah, we definitely keep light, and the goal for that beer and the reason we even brewed it was we wanted to have something in the lower alcohol level that was not too like our beers like ale and our other like hoppier farmhouse beers. But basically, so when we think about that beer, the primary thing going on in it is probably the yeast we're using, which is the French farmhouse yeast. I find that yeast in particular lends a lot of body to beer, even though it ferments beers practically to zero. We're left with almost no sugar in those beers. You know, we're at 0.5 Plato or so in our beers, or 1.002. I don't remember. I'd have to look at a hydrometer. But so we're getting a beer that's tremendously dry. But I mean, the base beer, and really in most of my beers, is typically like 90% pilsner and some wheat. You know, we don't brew very complicated grain bills in our farmhouse beers. We're more relying on the fermentation. So I knew that strain of yeast in particular gives a really nice full mouthfeel and an incredibly dry beer. When we ferment those, we don't control the fermentation temperature. So any of our farmhouse beers, I know sometimes homebrewers want to go to great extents to create some sort of fermentation chamber or, you know, do something, make a room really cold. And, you know, some of these beers are fermenting in excess of 90 degrees. So they're great for brewers, especially in, you know, the harder parts of the country, because, and that's really, I think, why we started brewing them for me, is it was a beer that was sturdy, could handle high fermentation temperatures, and then it works well here in Oklahoma where beer has to sit on the shelf warm. So our beers tend to improve as they sit, because we're naturally, you know, conditioning the bottles, and, you know, those styles just lend themselves to it. So we're creating, you know, a beer, this beer in, you know, a pretty low gravity, but a hot fermentation. And that's really where we get a lot of character. And there's a kind of a couple different schools of thought on that, and some people agree with the idea of the hot fermentation, others don't. I'm a fan of it and embrace it. So, but another thing, because we are trying to achieve as much of a dryness as we can, is that once our fermentation is complete, we'll even go as far as to add a white wine yeast to the beer to help condition it and even drop the gravity a little lower. And in our bigger bottle of beers, that'll also be one to two different strains of Brettanomyces as well. So our goal always is dryness. But I guess you mentioned a spicy note in there, and there is cracked black pepper that's added at the end of the boil as well. So, you know, you're left with a grain bill that's, like I said, mostly Pilsner, a little bit of wheat, and then, you know, like a Saaz type hopping. I think we went a little different here, and we used, like, I think it's called, like, Santium or Antium. I don't remember. I did look at the notes. It's a hop that I did a farmhouse beer with the brewer in Chicago, off color, and it's hops he wanted to use, and I liked him after that, so I stole that idea for this beer. But it's not incredibly hopped by any means, you know, a bittering addition and then a flame out addition, and that's how I brew most of my. I don't get too caught up in hop additions in the middle of the boil or 10 or 15 minutes out. It's at the beginning, at the end, at the whirlpool, and then dry hopped if we're going to dry hop. But like I said, black pepper, and there is orange peel in this beer as well. And each time we brew it, I think I dial it up a little higher each time because I want that to come through, but not go so high one time that it's just too much. So we're slowly dialing that into the beer, but black pepper adds a really nice spiciness that complements that yeast strain really well. So I don't know, that sounds like a bunch of rambling about the beer, but you know, for us, I feel like I have homebrewers often ask about like recipes and clones and stuff like that, and I feel like so much of what we do is more about our process than it is our ingredients. That you know, I feel like I could give someone a recipe and I don't know that it would quite taste the same, and that's true in any school of thought in brewing. But for us, the way we ferment our beer, the way we condition our beer, you know, to me, that's what makes our beers farmhouse beers. Where maybe someone else's idea is that if they just use a Saison yeast strain, they've made a farmhouse beer. I feel like there's a lot more that goes into it, especially with, I think, embracing simple ingredients and fermentation temperatures and, you know, our pursuit of dryness in our product. And like I said, we just don't use a lot of technology either in our brewing. We don't have complicated breweries for these beers. So that's something we'd kind of embrace. And I feel like is a part of what adds to the profile of our beers versus any recipe I could give someone.
Yeah, and I think that at some point, as homebrewers, instead of trying to replicate a beer that they've had, if they can use, the way I look at it is if you can use kind of the ideas that you're putting across and just trying your own twist on it and seeing what you could find out in your own brew house.
And I think like our beer, like Merica, which I wish we could brew again, but Nelson Sauvin hops are not attainable. But that's a great example where, I mean, it's a smash beer. It's 100% Pilsner malt and 100% Nelson Sauvin hops. And then, you know, our yeast strain that we use, and then two Brett strains. So I guess in that sense, there's more yeast involved. But it's literally just 100% Pilsner malt. And it's like it's complex and it's a really great beer. And, you know, I guess the one side of how we do that is, you know, at flame out, we use a pound and a half of hops per barrel, which in homebrew terms is a ton, and then 2 pounds per barrel dry hop. So there's just like a hell of a lot of hops in it. But all the funky and complex notes still come through in it, you know? So that's where I say our process is equally as important as the ingredients we're using, and that beer's proof in the fact that there's only Pilsner in it. And it's like cool Pilsner, like floor malted Bavarian Pilsner, but it's still just a single grain, you know.
So since you pitch multiple yeast strains, say in the Bura, if I were to harvest the dregs from one of your bottles, what impact would that have on any beers brewed from that?
I would feel like you would still get, if it was a beer with Brett in it, the Bretts would still come through. But ultimately, in my mind, that wine yeast just kind of would take over. It's far more aggressive than the ale strains. So I've been curious because I feel like I've seen people do it. Like, they're like, I'm culturing a prairie bottle. I'm like, I don't know that I would do that. But, you know, I haven't done it myself to really know how it would turn out. I mean, it'd probably still be pretty good, but I feel like there may be some harshness that might come from that wine yeast and allowing it to touch 100% of the fermentables versus the, you know, 1% to 0.5% that it does in our process.
Let's move on to the Prairie Ale, which is not a session beer. It says it's 8.2%.
Yeah, and that's the crazy part about it being 8.2%, and something we kind of learned, like, brewing these beers, is that it doesn't take a whole lot of gravity to get there when you're almost fermenting, like I said, everything out of the beer. So this beer, which would maybe only be about a 6% beer if it was, say, a pale ale, you know, we're getting all of that residual sweetness out of the beer to where, you know, it's going to dry it out a couple more, two to four more points, and you've had all of a sudden added 2% more alcohol in the beer. So that was a surprise to me, and it would. I think when we first released it was only like 7%, but then when you sell beer in Texas, you have to actually get things lab tested, and we tested it, like, oh, there's more in this than we realized, and that can happen too in the bottle conditioning and stuff and adding a little bit. So I'm not completely convinced it's that high, but their lab tested it at that, and I think it dropping that low and the extra bottle conditioning going on the bottle, because we're getting a lot of CO2 in these bottles too, we're constantly pushing them to the edge as far as the amount of carbonation the beer can really handle. You know, because you go too high and it'll just all gush out the top. But we're looking for highly carbonated beers because I feel like that's part of the farmhouse style. And so I imagine we're picking up maybe 0.5% of alcohol in the conditioning as well, because there's a lot of yeast that needs to be, a lot of sugar that needs to be consumed to hit those higher CO2 volumes.
Well, I said it didn't. In my notes, I said I would not have guessed that it was 8.2% because it doesn't taste that big at all. It's very, I said, very tasty, which is a generic term, but it's, I said, light and funky, and more funky than the Bura, obviously.
Yeah, so that beer itself has Brett Bruxellensis in it, Brett Brux, whatever you want to call it. And to me, that in our pursuit, we like that. It has definite layers of complexity, and my favorite part about that strain is the tropical fruit and pineapple notes that it adds to the beer. Again, to me, those are really complementary of the yeast we use to ferment the beer, but is really there for dryness and complexity. Playing with Brett like that's probably my favorite thing to do in a beer, and to me, like, when I taste a really great bready beer, it's like all I ever want to drink. You know, when I taste it, it just kind of hits me, and I'm like, man, this is all I want. You know, so it's just, and that's the thing about our beers, is it's all, this whole thing just kind of started with me and my brother, and he's the artist that does all the artwork on our bottles, and me saying, just do what you want. I'm gonna tell you the name of the beer, and you come up with the art, and I'm just gonna come up with something that sounds good to me. So we've never really done much to produce beer in an effort to please an audience. They've all been much more selfish art type endeavors for us. So, you know, someone complained once that, like, well, you just brew a whole bunch of saisons, and by necessity now we brew a whole bunch of stouts, which is the funny part of that wasn't on purpose. And I said, and my argument to that is well, yeah, because that's what I like. So that's why I brew them. I feel like the beer industry as a whole is growing so fast, and everyone's trying to be the next dude. And for us, it was, well, there's enough beer going on in this country that we can do specifically what we want, try to be specialists, and if people want to drink something that we don't make, then to get it from the other local guy in town or, you know, whomever else, you know. We probably won't make a double IPA, but there's certainly some great ones to try. And so to me, I don't feel like we have to do everything and touch on every style. Other brewers can do those better, and we just stick to what we know.
And the great thing about your relationship with your distributor is that you can send those beers across the country to those pockets of craft beer lovers out there who dig you, you know, so to speak, who get your philosophy and like what you're doing. And so you don't have to be saturated in Oklahoma. You're not selling to Tulsa. You're selling to all these other beer areas that are kind of clued in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what was really what I think helped us get our name out there, was being able to place our beer in places where you have some, like, I don't want to say like influential beer drinkers, but into these places like San Francisco and Chicago, where there's huge beer scenes. And so getting the recognition in those markets kind of naturally spread our name around to where we've gotten to today. So that's been a great part of our model, and that's why that's worked with only brewing kind of what we like, is, you know, and focusing on these farmhouse beers and stuff, is that we could sell beer in San Francisco because we're not out there trying to knock Lagunitas IPA off at the tap rooms, you know. We're trying to offer something that I feel like stands on its own for the most part, and becomes that specialty option for someone versus a staple, you know, and trying to replace those. And that's where I think it's worked for us with selling beer in so many places, is that we're not trying to be that beer that's in every bar. We're trying to be just in those places that, you know, those people that either, you know, go there or run it or own it, which typically would be the same instance, really kind of understand where we're coming from with our products and can appreciate them.
And you have to give a shout out to your brother Colin for his artwork on the labels, because it's it's as interesting as the beer inside.
Exactly. And that's where I think we've had a lot of success also. When I was working on the Redbud project a couple of years ago, I was trying to make the labels and do the artwork myself, and they're somewhat pathetic. So it's been awesome working with him and just letting his brain just go wherever it wants to take him. And it's cool because I feel like as we go along, he's really matured as an artist. And he's not a graphic artist by trade or anything. He didn't set out to do this. It's all just kind of happened, you know. And so it's cool because I'm watching him grow as an artist and change, and just as I am as a brewer. The further in we get, I feel like the better his work is getting and more complex. And, you know, he puts a lot of thought and meaning behind his art. Where I think earlier on it was just stuff that's like he thought was cool, is now much more personal to him, and he puts a lot into it.
Well, it's got that, what do they call it? There's a, what would you call the style? It's kind of a, not rustic, but, you know, there is kind of an untrained feel to it, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it can be, sometimes it can be a little raw. And then, you know, lately I feel like there's been a lot of finesse in what he's doing and a lot of detail. It's hard to explain because he's kind of weird. He'll always be my little brother, you know. And, like, he only works in the middle of the night. And then, like, you just wake up the next day to see what he's been working on. So I'm really excited about kind of the direction he's going with stuff, with, like, the beers, like Prairie Vision and Prairie Vice that are coming out of this facility. And I feel like the art in those is much more mature, and I feel like he's really challenging himself as an artist to sometimes before maybe taking the easy route and doing something kind of humorous, he's really shown that he's grown quite a bit with these newer labels.
Let's talk about Funky Galaxy, which is another, according to the label, 8% beer. It's a funky, hoppy beer. And here's my tasting notes. And keep in mind that I don't know if it was right after I had the Prairie Ale or not. But anyway, I said the funkiness strong up front, but seems to fade and be balanced with the hop character. Fairly light body. It's a dark beer. So just in my mind, whenever I see a really dark beer, I think it's going to be heavier tasting. But it has very little roast character that I could discern. Initially, when my nose hit the glass, I was like, "Whoa, that's pretty funky. How's that going to play with the hops?" But I don't know if it was my perceptions changing or if the beer actually breathed out some of the funkiness. But the funkiness balanced a lot better with the hoppiness as halfway down the glass. I thought it was really interesting and fun beer.
Yeah, that beer's really weird. So I feel like we've got people that love it and completely get it, or people that just think they just don't like it at all. And it's a weird concept, because really, it's brewed not too unlike, say, ale, but we're really just using, debittered, black malts and brewing really more or less in a Schwartz beer kind of style. So, in the most recent batch, we just used the Cinnamar, as a way to color it at the end of the boil. There's no roasted malts in it, which I feel like was the best batch when we switched from using a Caffra type malt to the Cinnamar and getting it much tighter as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, that beer uses Brett Lambicus, which is a much funkier strain to me than the Brux strain that we use. So it's a little more challenging in that sense. But to me, the great thing about using Brett in conjunction with hops is that the Brett, as it scavenges and eats the oxygen that's in the bottle up, it keeps the hops from getting too faded or oxidized themselves, and so it really Brett to me really preserves hop flavor in a way that we haven't brewed Funky Galaxy in a long time. But those bottles still taste pretty damn hoppy to me in a aromatic sense. So it was a weird thing where dark farmhouse beers, I think, are a tough deal, and I want to keep diving into it, but, there's sometimes it's a confusing beer. And it's one of those things where at that time we were just brewing beers and moving on to the next thing, so I didn't have a lot of thought into it as far as, it was just an idea and we did it, and then we kind of moved on, but yet the beer still lives, so it's funny to have to explain after the fact and that... I don't know what I was thinking. I think, what it was is that I think we added the Brett as kind of an afterthought to it. And originally it was just going to be our spin on a black IPA, which is kind of a thing, but in our Belgian kind of farmhouse translation. But then in the spur of the moment, I said, oh yeah, let's toss a couple Brett strains in there. And that's where the beer got, weird to me in a great way, but it would have otherwise been more like our beer Prairie Hop, which is really just more or less a Belgian IPA in a sense, but a black version. And it's kind of one of those oddball beers that you wouldn't find it anywhere here. But I find in other markets where, we're more on the fringe as far as beers in a bottle shop or whatever, you'll still see it, maybe in Arkansas or in Texas. But I've not seen it on a shelf in Oklahoma in probably 4 or 5 months.
And I've gone over the time that I promised you, but I do want to talk about the barrels behind you. What have you got going on in there?
Yeah, we really have too many different little projects going on there. And it's an exciting deal where I've got this Branson Jamboree program going on where we're taking 1 to 2 barrels and aging the same beer in small runs of barrels that will go unblended. So there's a Dickel whiskey barrel, there's different vintages of Elijah Craig, there's a 30-year-old Evan Williams barrel in there, tequila barrel, a Madeira wine barrel, And each of those will be bottled as individual batch numbers, so not too unlike what you know, the guys at 5050 do with their Eclipse, but a much smaller scale and really more just for the fun. And then the cool part is a lot of the barrels we've gotten from different liquor stores around the country, and so those beers, when those come out, will primarily be sold in those locations. You know, Brown Derby and Springfield and Wine and Cheese Place in Missouri, and we've gotten some from Healthy Spirits in San Francisco, and a few in maybe even a couple in Arkansas. But so when we sell those, there will always be some here in the Tulsa area, but probably mostly they'll go to any. So if any one barrel we get 50 cases out of, you know, we may ship 40 to that store and keep 10 to mix into production here. So it'll become one of those kind of fun things, like, to try to seek out all the batch numbers, I feel like, because we probably won't really tell people where they're going, but just more release them as they taste good. And we pulled a sample from the tequila barrel, which is a very old aged tequila barrel. It's just beautiful. I guess you gotta like tequila, though. So inevitably, when we release it, someone will complain because it tastes like tequila, and it's like, well, you bought the tequila aged beer. But I think it's fantastic, and I'm super excited to release it, because I feel like there haven't been a lot of home runs in tequila barrels, and I'm destined to make a good one. So I'm excited about it. Inevitably, some people will love it, some may not, but that'll be the cool thing about it, is, you know, we're taking that same base and playing around with it and giving people a chance to try some pretty cool stuff. So otherwise, yeah, we've got a lot of different wine barrels in here, some spontaneous cool ship style fermented beers, and a lot of different kind of sour things going on. So
yeah, and the spontaneously fermented beer was born in the back of your pickup truck.
Yeah, so that's Cool Ship truck, and it's a funny deal. I've become friends with Yepa from Evil Twin. I'm actually flying out to Brooklyn tomorrow. We're gonna launch Bible Belt out of his bar there, and he came in town and we brewed a couple of beers, a Goza, and this Cool Ship beer we did during our Christmas party here, and it was great because, like, everyone came, they had some beers, and there was food, and then, like, as the party ended, we filled it, so we just back loaded our dairy tank, which was our Cool Ship, into the back of the truck and just pulled it right outside the door of the brewery. And at the close of the party, we had, like, a fire going in the fire pit, and, you know, the beer going into this tank and just steam everywhere. Because obviously you're putting, you know, 200 degree stuff into a tank, and it was cold. It was when the first terrible weather out, and just ice and snow everywhere, which I think really helped the beer with it not being too warm. So we were able to, I think, really get some great bacteria out of it, because it already tastes great. I don't know what the rules are on when I can actually bottle it, being a spontaneous beer, because some people think it needs to sit a really long time. But, you know, I feel like at the 8-month mark, if it's as awesome as it is now, and hopefully, ideally, it'll be better, we'll go ahead and bottle it, and then next winter, probably make 10 times as much, because, and we'll, you know, hopefully, I say that, and then it won't turn out so good, but, of course, the two barrels we have are, I'm really excited about. So, you know, I think people have been able to, you know, really get behind the beers we're doing, but I honestly feel like the things that we have coming, and especially the stuff, the smaller runs coming out of this facility, you know, I feel like our best is yet to come.
Awesome. Well, thanks for all the time. I know you're busy. You got to get some good beers out across the country. So I appreciate your time, and good luck for the future, Chase.
Thanks a lot. Really appreciate it.
Well, thanks again to Chase. I'm glad to see Prairie Artisan Ales on the shelves here locally in Northwest Arkansas. Check out their website to see if they are near you. If you like fun and funky beers, they are worth a try. And when I say funky, I mean funky as in farmhouse funky, and also funky as in, you know, cool and interesting and, you know, funky. I'm looking forward to seeing what's going to come out of those barrels. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to James at basicbrewing.com. or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You will find our new bottle openers on our shop, at least for a limited time. Our Basic Brewing growler bags are available. Protect your precious home brew and craft beer as you take it from place to place. Check out our support link, where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And for a limited time, with every DVD combo, you'll get a free bottle opener included. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. Our brewer's logbooks are on there. You can keep track of about 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We greatly appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are 15-gallon home beer brewing hot liquor tank and Shakespeare Star Wars tackle box. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping. We greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association and subscribe to Brew Your Own magazine through the associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.